first pass down the street, circling the block to get a feel for the neighborhood. Ramona Road was one block long, looping back on itself like a lasso. The lots were hilly, largely given over to trees and scrub. The natural contours of the land left little room to build. Graders and excavators had gone to work, carving out the flats on which construction had gone up. The houses dated back to the 50s, all of them the work of one architect, whose modern style still looked fresh 30 years later. I parked the Mustang on a grassy patch across the road from 625. Sutton leaned forward in the passenger seat and looked searchingly through the windshield. A swath of green lawn sloped upward toward the house, the long paved driveway forming a half circle as it curved down and touched the road again. The Kirkendalls' former residence was a one-story structure in the shape of an inverted L, with a short arm extended toward the street. The exterior of the house was red brick and darkly stained redwood, with bold horizontal lines and generous expanses of glass. The flat concrete roof formed a wide overhang that shaded the veranda along the front. There were no flourishes, no embellishments, and no unnecessary touches. "This can't be right," Sutton said. "Yes, it is. In 1967, there was only one Kirkendall in town, and this is where they lived."
"But where's the second floor?"
"Billy Kirkendall was sick. He stayed upstairs, and I stayed down." "Oh, shit, I'd forgotten that. Wait here, and I'll see if the owner's home. Maybe we can get permission to explore." I got out of the car and dog-trotted across the road. The driveway didn't appear steep, but I was winded by the time I reached the top. The place had an air of emptiness, a house enveloped in quiet. The windows were bare, and there was no sign of a doormat or any of the homely touches that indicate someone in residence. A band of damp paving along the front suggested that the sprinklers were still active, probably governed by the same automatic program that regulated indoor temperatures and turned lights off and on. I went up a low step to the entrance, where a panoramic wall of glass afforded me an unobstructed view of the interior. The architect had kept the non-load-bearing walls to a minimum, and the blonde hardwood floor seemed to stretch in all directions. Light poured in from everywhere. A stone fireplace was offset on the far wall, and I could see a length of kitchen counter that had been stripped of small appliances. To the right was the empty dining room, with a low-hanging light fixture centered in the ceiling. I walked to my right along the veranda, where I could see a large bedroom with white wall-to-wall carpeting and mirrored sliding doors, one partially open to reveal cavernous closet space. I returned to the front door and noticed for the first time an alarm company decal saying "armed response" pasted to one corner of the glass. The warning was probably more form than content. It seemed unlikely that anyone would pay for security services when the house stood empty. I was assuming the property was on the market, but there was no realtor's lockbox and no stack of brochures detailing the floor plan, the square footage, or the number of rooms. For sale signs were prohibited by the Homeowners Association. For all I knew, every house in Horton Ravine was up for grabs. I rang the bell with no expectation of a response. I left the porch, intending to circle the premises. Sutton must have been clued into the fact that the house was vacant because he emerged from the Mustang and crossed the road as I had. I waited while he climbed the drive, and then the two of us traced a path around the house to the rear. Below, on a wide concrete apron, there was a swimming pool and a cabana surrounded on two sides by a plain concrete wall with an outdoor fireplace and built-in barbecue pit. Sutton turned and looked at the rear elevation. From this vantage point, the two-story construction was evident. The house had been tucked in against the steep hill, and a series of windows looked out on the view. Beyond the patio, the property sloped down again sharply, and thick railroad ties had been cut into the hillside to form a crude staircase. The neighbors' rooftops floated like rafts on a lake of dark green treetops. "Look familiar?" "I guess. I thought the house was much bigger." "A lot of things look bigger when you're six." "There wasn't a swimming pool. I'd have remembered it." "I've done the research, and this is where you were." The pool and the barbecue could have been added later, I said. Let's take a walk down the hill. If you wandered, that would have been your only choice. The brush had been cleared within a 20-foot radius along the slope, probably by order of the fire department. Sutton followed me reluctantly as I crossed the grass and made my descent. There was no handrail, and the steps themselves were deep, with 10-inch risers that forced us to descend the stairs like toddlers, putting both feet on every step before moving to the next. This portion of the lot was useless to all intents and purposes. A series of terraces had been carved out of the hill. The first level was planted with dwarf fruit trees. The second offered shelter in a weathered wood pagoda, lined with benches, and bleached by the elements to a soft silver gray. The third was given over to rose beds that, at this point, were sadly neglected. After that, the land fell away gradually. The bottom of the hill butted into a grove of trees that stretched out on either side in varying degrees of density. I counted 3 large oaks and 6 mature black acacias. Clusters of pittosporum and eucalyptus were intermingled with saplings. I wouldn't have called this the woods, but to Sutton, at the age of 6, it might have looked like one. Where the undergrowth was thin, I could see sections of a paved road that must have been Via Giuliana, one of the primary arteries through Horton Ravine. If I'd been searching for a secluded location to serve as a gravesite, I wouldn't have picked this. From above, the hillside was open to view. Given the staggered pattern of trees below, the area would have been visible from the road as well. Sutton stood there, his hands in his pants pockets, his gaze moving across the landscape as he struggled to get his bearings. I could see his confusion now that he was faced with a scene that had seemed so vivid in his mind. He moved to his right, traipsing through knee-high weeds before he came to a standstill. A fence blocked his path, the chicken wire sagging under a swarm of morning glory vines. The sign affixed to the fence post read, "Do not trespass. Private property. Keep out. No access to bridle trail. This means you." He walked up the hill for a distance, peering at the trees in range of him. He stopped again and shook his head. "This is all wrong. I don't see the tree I used as a hideout, and I don't see the oak I hid behind when I was spying on the guys. Maybe the oak was cut down. But the fence is wrong, too. Where did that come from? I didn't climb a fence, I'm sure of it. This is all screwed up." "Sutton, it's been years. Take your time." He shook his head in frustration. "Would you quit being so negative?" I said. "I'm not negative." "You are, too. You should listen to yourself." He turned and scanned the woods again, no happier than he'd been. The guy was getting on my nerves. I watched while he walked down the hill toward the trees. I followed the sagging fence line, as he had. But where he went down the hill, I climbed up. A profusion of wildflowers had sprung up among the grasses. Grasshoppers skittered ahead of me as I walked. I turned and looked back as Sutton disappeared into the trees. Below and to my right, I caught a glimpse of the rear of a house. Patio doors, a deck, an outdoor table and chairs. Since I wasn't well acquainted with the neighborhood, I couldn't judge the relationships between properties. The irregular course the fence had taken suggested it had been erected in conformity with a meandering lot line, separating the parcel that fronted Ramona Road from one that faced the secondary road below. Dimly, I remembered the fork, where a smaller tributary split off from Via Giuliana. From where I stood, only the one house was visible, but there were doubtless others on that same street. Sutton whistled, a shrill, piercing note forced from between taut lips and teeth. For years, I'd worked to master the technique, but usually managed little more than an asthmatic wheeze and the risk of hyperventilation. I set off, trudging down the hill in his general direction. He emerged to the left of me and waved. I picked my way across the uneven ground, trying to avoid the numerous holes housing God knows what assortment of rodents. I followed Sutton into a clearing shaded by a canopy of trees. Here, the temperature was 10 degrees cooler than the sun-drenched hill. The far side of the glade was open to Via Giuliana. A riding trail angled across the open space, its muddy surface punctuated by hoofprints. The trail was clearly well used, dotted with fresh horse manure as well as desiccated mounds of previous equine BMs. In the center of the clearing, there was a stone horse trough, 3 feet by 6. The water was fed through a pipe linked to a circulating pump that kept the depths aerated and algae-free. The stone was darkening with age, and the shimmering pool looked cold and black. Sutton said, "I'd forgotten about this. The Horton Ravine Riding Club is just across the road. I played in the trough that day, floating leaves like boats. It was afterward I climbed the hill and came across the tree I used as my hideout." "Nanny, nanny, boo-boo, told you so," I said. "I'm not paying you to make fun of me."
"Then you shouldn't be such a pill."
"Sorry." "Forget it. Let's focus on the job at hand. When you saw the guys, in what direction were they walking?" "Actually, they were coming up the hill from here. They must have parked along Via Juliana and passed through this clearing. The tree where I was hiding was partway up the slope, so I was looking down on them. They crossed my field of vision from left to right and moved off in that direction. So, if the fence was there, they'd have had to climb over it, which means you'd have done the same thing," I said. "But I didn't."
"Would you stop that? I'm not saying you did. I'm saying we should knock on some doors and see if someone knows what year the fence went in."
We climbed up the hill again, moving up the steps from terrace to terrace, until we reached the wide, flat patio with its pool, cabana, and built-in barbecue pit. We went around the side of the house and then crossed the front lawn to the house next door. I rang the bell. Sutton stood behind me and to my right. To anyone inside with an eye to the peephole, we'd look like Jehovah's Witnesses, only not as well-dressed. Sutton shifted uneasily. "What are you going to say?"
"Haven't made that part up yet," I said.
The young woman who opened the door had a 6-month-old baby clamped on her right hip. He had a pacifier in his mouth that wiggled as he sucked. His face was flushed, and his hair had been flattened in a series of damp ringlets. I was guessing he'd recently awakened from his nap and, judging from his aura of fecal perfume, was in desperate need of a diaper change. He was at that clinging monkey stage where his hold on his mother was pure instinct. I could see clutch marks in the fabric of her blouse where his grip had made star shapes across the front. His resemblance to her was eerie. Same noses, same chins, 2 sets of identical blue eyes looking back at me. His dark lashes were longer and thicker than hers, but life is basically unfair, and what's the point of protest? I said, "Hi, sorry to disturb you, but is the house next door for sale? We heard it was on the market, but there's no realtor's sign, and we didn't know who to contact." She peered in that direction and made a face. "I don't know what to tell you. The couple got divorced, and for a while the ex-husband was living there with his girlfriend, a ditz half his age. They moved out a month ago, and we heard he's looking for tenants on a long-term lease. I can give you his number if you're interested." With skepticism, I said, "Gee, I don't know about renting. I hadn't thought about that. How much does he want?" "He's talking $7,000 a month, which I think is way too much. It's a nice house and all, but who wants to spend that kind of dough?"
"That is pushing it," I said.
"Do you happen to know how much property he has?"
5 acres, give or take."
"That's a good-sized lot. When we walked up the hill just now, we saw a fence with a do not trespass sign, but we couldn't tell if it was part of this parcel or the one next door." She lifted a thumb, jerking it backward to indicate something behind her. "The guy down there could tell you. I know there was a lot line adjustment years ago, but I'm not sure what changed. The utility company has an easement that extends along the hill, and riders keep mistaking it for part of the bridle trail. The owner got fed up with all the horses crossing his land, so that's where the fence came from."
"He's the one in that house I can see below yours?"
"Right, on Alita Lane. His name's Felix Holderman. He's retired and he's nice enough, but he's sometimes gruff. I don't know the house number, but it's the only Spanish style on the block." "Thanks. We may just pop down there and have a chat with him."
If you catch him at home, tell him Judy said hi. I'll do that. Appreciate your time. I should thank you. This is the first adult conversation I've had since Monday when my husband left on a business trip. When does he get back? Tomorrow, I hope. The baby's teething and I haven't slept for days. She wrinkled her nose, looking down at him. P.U. Is that him or you? I could hear a phone ring somewhere in the house. Oops, sorry, she said, and eased the door shut. Sutton and I headed down her drive to the car. I can't believe she didn't ask why you were quizzing her about the fence. If you're not buying or renting, then what's it to you? I didn't say I wouldn't rent, I said. I hadn't thought about that. But you didn't get the guy's number when she offered it. Sutton, the trick in a situation like this is to behave as though your questions are completely reasonable. Most people aren't going to stop to ponder the inconsistencies. It still seems pushy. Of course. We picked up my car and drove the short half mile from Ramona Road to Alita Lane. It wasn't hard to spot the Spanish-style house, which was long and low, a cream-colored stucco with a small courtyard in front and a three-car garage on one end. As I got out of the Mustang, Sutton said, "You mind if I wait here? I feel like a dunce standing behind you not saying a word while you chat people up." "Suit yourself. I'll be right back." I crossed the street and passed through the wrought iron gate into the inner courtyard. The front door was inset with three panels of stained glass that depicted a rose, a donkey, and a saguaro cactus with a sombrero perched on top. I rang the bell. The balding man who opened the door had a leathery face and a pate splotched with sun damage where hair had once been. He was roughly my height, 5'6", with a barrel chest and a tangle of white hair sprouting from the V of his Hawaiian shirt. His shorts revealed bowed legs the color of caramel corn. "Mr. Holderman?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"My name's Kinsey Milhone," I said. "I was just looking at a house for sale on Ramona Road, and the woman next door thought you could answer questions about the property. Her name's Judy, by the way, and she said to tell you hi."
"Judy's a nice gal. Tell her hi back from me. You're talking about Bob Tinker's place. Well built, but it's overpriced. House is worth 3.5 tops, and he's asking 6, which is ridiculous."
"Judy says he moved out and he hopes to rent or lease."
"Man's a fool. Anything he has, he thinks is worth double the actual value. You said questions."
"I was wondering about the lot line. I have a friend waiting in the car who played on that hill as a child. There was an old oak he loved, but when we walked the property just now, he said the big tree he remembers is gone and the wire fence is new."
"I wouldn't say new. I put that fence in 15 years ago, for all the good it does. Riders go over or around it. I might as well set up a toll booth and make 'em pay. You talk about trees. We lost a dozen or more in a storm some years back. Two eucalyptus and a big live oak went down. The oak was a beauty, too, a big guy, probably 150 years old. It might well be the one he's talking about. The utility company should have kept the deadwood trimmed. Tree was on the easement and had nothing to do with me, or I'd have pruned it myself. Winds came up and the damn thing split in half, taking out trees on both sides. Woke me up out of a sound sleep."
"Must have been a mess," I said.
"Big time. The utility company sent a fellow with a chainsaw to clear the downed trees. He wasn't paid to work that hard, so he took his sweet time. 10 minutes worth of sweat and then a cigarette break. Went on for days. I know because I watched. Pay minimum wage, you get minimum work. Nobody seems to get that. Took him 3 weeks.
I half turned, indicating Sutton in my car. "Would you mind if the two of us went up and looked around? It would mean a lot to him."
"Fine with me. Half the fallen trees were actually on the property next door. House has been sold twice. The current owners are off at work, but I don't think they'd mind if you wander a bit. You see anybody on horseback, you hightail it right back and let me know. I'm tired of the horseshit and horseflies."
Amen to that. Chapter 8.
Sutton and I walked between the two houses, Felix Holderman's on our left and his neighbor's to the right, with Alita Lane behind us. At one time, the backyards might have been open to one another, creating a wide mantle of rolling lawns. With the introduction of swimming pools, fences had been erected to protect kids from mishaps and property owners from pricey lawsuits. Between the greensward on this side and the barren hill above there was a dense band of trees, pines and spruces, with a few sycamores and acacia thrown into the mix. Again, I wouldn't have called this the woods, though it was more sheltered than the Kirkendalls' property where we'd started our search. The full-skirted evergreens did shield the area from view. I couldn't see the wire fence with its burden of morning glories, but it had to be somewhere above us. Where we were, there was no reason to post a no trespassing sign, because the natural undergrowth formed a barrier sufficient to block equestrian traffic. Riders following the marked trail wouldn't wander this far afield. Once we entered the trees, the ground was matted with decomposing plant material that sent up puffs of peat scent as we passed. There was no path to follow, so we were forced to create our own. We split up and tramped through the brush, snapping twigs and fallen branches underfoot. I heard Sutton's startled exclamation, "Found it!" I waded through the scrub and waist-high weeds, holding my arms up like a swimmer moving toward the shallow end of a pool. When I reached him, I saw the stump of the fallen oak, which was easily 6 feet across and hewn to 8 inches or so above ground. The tree trunk was hollowed by rot. The oak must have been dying from the inside out over a period of time, which meant the split wasn't entirely due to the weight of the branches, as Mr. Holderman had thought. "This is it?" I asked. "I think so. I'm almost sure." "Where were the guys when you caught up with them?" Sutton pivoted and scanned his surroundings. "Down there." His focus shifted from tree to tree, and his gaze finally came to rest at a point some 15 feet away. He moved in that direction, and I lagged a short distance behind, watching as he reached a small clearing and stopped to study it. The circular patch of ground was bordered by tall evergreens and mature live oak. The tree roots had sucked all the nutrients from the hard-packed soil, leaving bare dirt. He moved a few feet to his right. "This is where they were digging. The bundle on the ground was under that tree." He shook his head. "The place still smells the same. When you're a kid, everything is so intense. It's like you're filtering reality through your nose. Wonder why that is." "Survival. Catch the scent of a bear once and you carry the scent's memory for life." Sutton closed his eyes and took a deep breath. "Are you okay?" I asked. "I'm fine. It just seems weird." I took Sutton with me to the office where I unlocked the door and flipped on a few lights. He slouched in the chair he'd occupied the day before, stretching his legs out in front of him. I settled in my swivel chair, picked up the handset, and punched in Cheney's number at the police department. As soon as he picked up, I identified myself. "How's it going?" he asked. I laid out the sequence of events, starting with my trip to Climping Academy, and ending with Sutton's identification of the area where he'd seen the two guys digging. When I finished, there was a silence while he digested the information. He said, "I have to talk to the detective sergeant. I'll call you back." I wasn't sure how long we'd have to wait, but it was clear I needed to stay put so Cheney could get back to me if need be. "You want coffee? I can make a pot," I said. "No, thanks. I'm wired as it is. You have a bathroom I could use?" "Take a left in the hall. It's the only door on your right." "Thanks." It was 3:15, and I couldn't remember if I'd eaten lunch, which probably meant I hadn't. I opened my desk drawers in turn, but there wasn't so much as a tic-tac in the way of nourishment. I picked up my shoulder bag and went into search and seizure mode, peering into every crack and crevice. I like a big bag with a lot of nooks and crannies. Outside compartments for magazines and books, inside pockets, some with zippers, some without, and a pouch on one end for car keys. I found two red and white striped peppermints in clear cellophane. They'd been in my bag so long the mints had softened and were now welded to the wrapping. I could have popped one in my mouth as it was and made it last for days. I heard a toilet flush, and moments later, Sutton reappeared. "Want a mint?" I asked. "No, thanks." He resumed his seat and watched me peel the cellophane off the mint. He stirred restlessly. "So, what happens next?" I laid the mint on my tongue. It was heavenly to feel the sugar surge through my mouth. I tucked it in against my inner cheek so I could talk without spitting. I said, "No idea. I guess it depends on how seriously they're taking this." We sat there in silence. I picked up a letter opener and tapped the point against the edge of my desk, practicing to be a drummer in case the private eye biz dried up. Sutton spent his time looking around the office at the bad paint job and the so-called wall-to-wall carpeting that had seen better days. I could tell he wasn't impressed. I make enough money to support myself, but I'm not big on decor. Then again, neither was he. Given what I'd seen of his place, he was hardly one to offer decorating tips. I don't keep magazines in my office. I'm not a doctor or a dentist, so what's the point? Someone comes to see me and I'm here, we sit down and talk. If I'm not here, the door's locked and they have to wait. Sutton didn't seem any better equipped than I was for chit-chat. I'd known the guy one day, and now that we'd gotten the potty question and the mint behind us, conversationally speaking, we had nothing to say to each other. I'm deficient when it comes to small talk, which is probably why I have so few friends. I sat in my swivel chair, willing the phone to ring, and when it did, I jumped. It was Cheney. "Roosevelt says we can take a couple of crime scene techs and a canine unit out to the site. We're rounding people up now and should be ready to roll within the hour." "Great. That's great." I gave him the address, and we spent a few minutes chatting about the logistics. Alita Lane was too narrow to accommodate vehicles and miscellaneous police personnel, so we agreed to meet at the roadside parking strip near the polo field on Via Giuliana. That settled, I dropped Sutton off at his house so he could pick up his car. On the way back to Horton Ravine, I stopped at McDonald's and scarfed down a quarter pounder and fries. I wasn't sure how long the excavation would take, and I wanted to make sure I had a wholesome meal under my belt. The soft drink I ordered was a small one. No point in taxing my bladder when relief wouldn't be in range. I arrived before Cheney did, and used the time to change into an old pair of running shoes I kept in the trunk of my car. I hauled out my navy windbreaker and shrugged into that as well. The light was still good, but the sun was sinking, taking the pleasant daytime temperatures with it. Sutton arrived in his MG and parked in beside my Mustang. He had the top down, and Madeline, the ex-addict, was in the car with him, which annoyed me no end. This wasn't date night, and it wasn't a public spectacle. We were dealing with life and death, and I didn't want her hanging around like she was part of the scene. Goldie Hawn, Madeline's golden retriever, sat on her lap, with her chin resting on the lowered window. I'd swear the dog knew who I was and sent me a loopy, doggy smile by way of recognition. Madeline's circulation must have taken a beating with 80 pounds of dog planted on her thighs. As I watched, she lifted a beer can to her lips and treated herself to a sip. So much for open container laws. Cheney finally showed up. The canine handler and cadaver dog were in a separate black and white that pulled in beside his car. 2 minutes later, one of the two evidence techs arrived, followed by the mobile crime lab with the second tech riding in the back. It looked like a circus arriving in town, men and equipment being set up for all the falderall to come. We had to wait for the photographer, but that gave Cheney the opportunity to approach the house on the property where they intended to dig. He was gone for 10 minutes, talking to the couple whose hillside they wanted to invade. The rest of us had emerged from our respective vehicles, and we stood on the parking strip like extras on a movie set. We had nothing to do, but most people there were being paid for doing it. Sutton walked Cheney and the techs out to the burial site. Madeline and I were relegated to the sidelines while professionals went to work. Two officers returned to the car to pick up traffic cones and the yellow plastic tape that would define the area. I wouldn't be allowed within a 50-yard radius, so I occupied my time chatting with the canine officer I knew from times past. Gerald Pettigrew had been a beat cop in my neighborhood some 6 years before. In those days, he'd been hefty, a black guy in his 30s with beefy shoulders and a gut on him that would be a liability in a foot chase. By the same token, if he managed to overtake you, you'd wish you'd run a lot faster because the guy could hand out punishment. He'd lost weight since I'd seen him last, a side effect of his working with the Golden Lab he introduced as Bell. Madeline took the occasion to let Goldie Hawn hop out of the car. The two dogs went through the usual hiney-smelling nice-meeting-you routine. Anyone who knows me will testify I'm not a fan of dogs, but I hadn't felt at all hostile to these two. I took this as a sure sign I was getting old. Far from becoming set in my ways, my defenses were breaking down. At this rate, in another few years, the whole world would come rushing in and smother me with kindness. I let Belle sniff my hand, which is something I'd seen other people do in the company of cats and dogs. I hoped the gesture would stave off a sudden snarling attack that would remove half my arm. I looked up at Gerald. I pictured a bloodhound or a German shepherd. A lot of breeds are good for search and seizure, which is what they're usually trained for first. They learn to locate lost hikers or kids who wander off on a camping trip. You need a dog with a powerful retrieval instinct, keen sense of smell, and a strong work drive. Even then, some are better than others. The last dog I worked with was a shepherd. He was good, but high-strung, and he had a tendency to mope. Great nose, but it was clear the work upset him. I finally retired him because I couldn't bear the accusatory look in his eyes. What happened to him? He's now the family watchdog, which suits him better than sniffing for dead bodies in the underbrush. I heard about Belle through a friend of a friend who'd been breeding labs for years. She was just a little furball when I got her, but smart as they come. Labs are easy to train, and they're physically strong. They're also good-natured, which is great for PR purposes. I can take her into schools and nursing homes, and everybody falls in love with her. By then, Belle was lying on the grass at his feet, her gaze flicking across his face as he spoke. He smiled at her. Look at that. She knows I'm bragging about her. Does she work on a leash or off? That depends on the terrain. Here I'll take her off the leash and let her go about her business. If she finds something, she'll come get me and take me back with her. Chaney reappeared and headed in our direction. Gerald signaled to Belle and the two walked out to meet him. A portable generator had been hauled out on the site, along with the big lamps that would make it possible to continue working when the daylight waned. I knew without even being present what the scene would look like. The digging would be done by hand. Two officers would run the loose dirt through a two-man sieve, hoping to capture any physical evidence left behind. The chances seemed slim to me, but these guys knew what they were doing, and who was I to say? The entire process would be photographed and sketched, with relevant landmarks noted and measurements taken to ensure that a thorough record of the scene was kept. The rest of us were left to amuse ourselves as best we could. A number of cars slowed and then moved on. As is usual, bystanders had begun to assemble. I assumed some were neighbors and others driving past the scene on the way home from work who had spotted the police cars and pulled in to see what was going on. There was nothing to do and not much to say after the first scanty explanations were passed along to new arrivals. People lingered, unwilling to leave before the final moments had played out. It was like being in a waiting room while someone else is giving birth. There was no drama in our immediate vicinity, but we all knew something important was going on. Such gatherings are often written off as morbid curiosity. Looky-loos, hoping for a glimpse of the injured or the dead. I prefer to attribute the behavior to a sense of community. People drawn together in the face of inconceivable tragedy. Sutton had returned to the parking area, and I could see him talking to a man nearby, filling him in. It was a story he'd tell repeatedly if Mary Claire's body came to light. Madeline, still wearing her short shorts, had pulled on a pair of leggings and a loose-necked sweatshirt that hung off one shoulder, exposing the same tank top I'd seen earlier. She sat in Sutton's MG, smoking cigarettes, with the passenger side door open. I'd spent half a day in Sutton's company, and I already felt a motherly urge to warn him about skanks and tramps like her. "What's going on?" I looked to my right and found a woman standing next to me, early 30s, by my guess. She had shiny, shoulder-length brown hair, blunt-cut and very straight. Her glasses were frameless, and the lenses accented the brown eyes behind them. I said, "The police may have a line on an unsolved case." "Really? What's the deal? Remember when Mary Claire Fitzhugh disappeared? Someone came forward with information about two guys digging what might turn out to be her grave." We exchanged idle remarks with our attention turned toward Alita Lane. I glanced at her outfit. Brown blazer, tweed skirt, black tights, loafers. Wondering how she managed to look so sensible and stylish at the same time. "Where'd the tip come from?" she asked. "Someone read an article about the kidnapping. He thinks he might have stumbled on the burial when he was a kid." "Wow, that would be a break after all this time," she remarked. "So, what's your connection?" "I'm a PI in town. I know Cheney Phillips, the lead investigator." "Cool. I've known Cheney for years. What about you? How'd you end up here?" I asked. "I work for the dispatch. One of the guys picked up chatter about it on the scanner and sent me to see what was happening." "Not much at this point," I said. "I'm not crazy about reporters, and I didn't want her probing for my client's identity. I didn't even want her to know I had a client because she'd try angling for an interview." "How'd you hear about it?" she asked. Her tone was casual, and the line was delivered as a throwaway, as though she had little or no interest in my response. This was crafty reporter small talk designed to elicit information. "Long story," I said. "Mind if I get your name?" "You can keep my name out of it. This is not about me." "No problem. If you don't want to be quoted, we can keep this off the record." "What's to quote? I don't know anything." "Fair enough. I'm Diana Alvarez, by the way." She held out her hand. Without pausing to consider, I shook hands with her and said, "Kinsey Milhone." The second the words came out of my mouth, I knew I had been had. So much for keeping my name out of it. I was irritated at her for maneuvering me, and irritated at myself for being so easily sucked in. "Nice meeting you," she said, and then she wandered away. While I watched, she removed a spiral-bound notebook from her blazer pocket and started scribbling on a page. She struck up a conversation with someone else, and I knew she'd weasel her way through the onlookers until she pieced the story together, no telling what kind of spin she'd put on it. I looked for Sutton, thinking to warn him, but he was nowhere to be seen. I was happy I'd grabbed dinner because it took until 8 p.m. for the techs to finish their work. Everything seemed to shut down at once. Cheney appeared at the mouth of Alita Lane and walked toward us on Via Giuliana. One uniformed officer followed, toting cones and the yellow tape that he'd wound into a loose skein. Gerald Pettigrew and Bell followed, giving no indication whether the dig had served up anything of note. Diana Alvarez separated herself from the guy she was pumping and made a beeline for Cheney in full reporter mode. Cheney acknowledged her, but his eyes were on me. I did a quick visual search of the bystanders, looking for Sutton, thinking he should be the first in line for the news, whatever it might be. Still no sign of him. His turquoise MG was parked on the berm with Madeline in the front seat, her feet propped on the dashboard. Goldie Hawn wandered from person to person, wagging her tail and receiving affectionate pats and praise from strangers, as was her due. I couldn't read Cheney's expression. He looked serious, but there was a suggestion of humor in his eyes. Diana Alvarez was close on his heels, eager for any news he intended to pass along. When he reached me, he said, "Hold out your hand. I have a present for you." I held out my hand, and he dropped an object in my palm. I registered a mud-caked plastic disc attached to a length of dirty blue leather. "What's this?"
"What's it look like?"
"A dog tag. That's what the two guys were burying. The family pet. Woof woof."
He smiled and moved on.
Chapter 9. Walker McNally. Late Thursday afternoon, April 7th, 1988. Walker McNally drove his black Mercedes through the entrance to Horton Ravine, as he did every day on his way home from work. Occasionally, he elected to use the back entrance, but he didn't much care for the associations. It was Thursday afternoon. Carolyn and the kids had left that morning for San Francisco, where they'd spend a long weekend with her mother, returning Monday afternoon. Fletcher, age 4, and Linny, age 2, were still in preschool, so whisking them off for 5 days with Nana wasn't an issue. Though he'd missed them, he looked forward to the empty house, keenly aware that he was on his own and could do as he pleased. He and Carolyn had moved back to California 10 years earlier, when he'd been hired as VP of New Client Relations at Montebello Bank and Trust. He'd begun his financial career in the trust department at Chase Manhattan Bank in New York City, and later joined Wells Fargo as a wealth planning specialist. The job opening in Santa Teresa had been a blessing, since Walker had grown up in town, graduating from UCST in 1971. He was a good-looking man, personable, charming, and articulate. A good part of his day, he was on the phone, setting up meetings and lunch dates, arranging drinks and dinner with prospective clients whose business he was working to gain. He served on the boards of 2 nonprofit organizations, and he was also involved in a number of planned giving and development committees. He'd brought a goodly number of clients to the bank during his tenure, and he was rewarded accordingly. Carolyn was the one who first raised the issue of what she referred to as his drinking problem. She'd apparently been monitoring his intake, counting the number of beer, wine, and liquor bottles that went into the trash. He wasn't sure how long this had been going on, but she'd finally put her foot down. He was of Scots descent, fair-haired, blue-eyed, with a complexion that was ruddy by nature. Alcohol had added a tinge of pink to his cheeks and a faint puffiness to his face. He knew he'd packed on a few pounds the last couple of years. At 38, he was on the high side of the suggested boundaries for his height and weight. He'd quit smoking, and that had added the obligatory 15 pounds. While he intended to work out, there wasn't much opportunity during the week. To his way of thinking, Carolyn's concerns were misplaced. Even when he'd belted down a few, he wasn't boisterous. His speech wasn't slurred. He was never goofy or maudlin or sloppy or mean-spirited. Drunk, he looked and behaved exactly as he did when he was sober. At least, according to his perceptions. Nonetheless, he'd promised her he'd rein himself in. She urged him to join AA, but he'd balked at that. He didn't need outside help to get his drinking under control. He had absolutely no intention of standing up at a public meeting with God knows who present, confessing his sins and looking for approbation. He'd always been a man who held his liquor well, and his heft actually allowed him to metabolize alcohol more efficiently than many guys his age. He had to admit that after a couple of hours at the club, if he were stopped by the CHP, he could probably pass a field sobriety test. But he'd blow a blood alcohol level that would put him in jail. Happily for him, he'd managed to restrict his drinking the past 8 months. He'd have a beer or two after working in the yard, or he'd sip the occasional glass of champagne, celebrating an occasion such as a birthday or an anniversary. He made sure Carolyn knew and approved of these exceptions because it underscored his stance of moderation. She'd never believe it if he claimed he'd quit altogether. She knew him better than that. Now, at business lunches and dinners, he bypassed hard liquor in favor of white wine, which scarcely registered on his internal alcohol meter. Going dry was really no big deal. He made do with iced tea or soda water with lime. He slept better and he had more energy, but he noticed he was often bored. Friends and cohorts who seemed so amusing when he drank began to get on his nerves. He wasn't as smooth or relaxed as he'd been in the past,
and he was aware that certain of his friends now shied away from him. And why would they not? He thought teetotalers were a tiresome bunch, and he was sorry he'd been thrust into their ranks. It was also true that the temptation to drink was with him every minute of every day, like a low-grade headache he didn't know how to shake. With Carolyn gone, he tooled along Via Giuliana, actively fantasizing about the highball he'd make for himself when he got home. He planned to sit on the back patio, which Carolyn had recently refurbished with faux wicker furniture, upholstered in a fabric impervious to the elements. Rain and sun could beat down on the cushions without ill effect. The view from the back terrace was still amazing to him, stretching across the hills and treetops all the way to the ocean. The air would be still, smelling of sage and bay laurel. He'd take his time savoring a pre-dinner cocktail. Then he'd have a pizza delivered and eat in front of the television set. Maybe catch a golf match or a guy flick of the sort Carolyn would find tedious. He might allow himself a wee nightcap, but he'd wait and see what his mood was when the time came. He didn't feel the same compulsion to drink as he had in the past. This was purely for the pleasure of it. On his way home from the office, he'd stopped at the liquor depot and picked up a pint of Maker's Mark, a quart of vodka, and a six-pack of Bass Ale, which he intended to parcel out to himself over the 4 nights his family would be gone. All he had to do then was dispose of the empties before Carolyn got home. Would she ever know? He thought not. He'd keep his drinking simple. Whiskey with a water back, vodka over ice, and remove any telltale evidence first thing Monday morning. No mixers in the liquor cabinet, no bottle caps in the trash, no cut limes in the fridge, and no conspicuous rings on the glass-topped table where he'd be sitting while the sun went down. Ahead of him, at the curve, cars had slowed, and he wondered if there'd been an accident. Maybe someone had hit a deer. He hoped to God it wasn't a kid on a bike. Fletcher had just mastered his two-wheeler. Linny was still riding a tricycle, and then only in the park. He wasn't sure he'd ever permit them to take their bikes on a public road. There wasn't much vehicular traffic through Horton Ravine, but at the end of the workday, when people headed for home, they often drove faster than the posted limit. As he got closer, he spotted two cop cars and a mobile evidence van parked on the berm, which suggested an event of a more serious sort. He slowed. There was a smattering of people standing by the road, looking idle and indecisive. The crowd was modest, and it was clear they didn't quite know what to do with themselves. On impulse, he pulled onto the gravel strip where a number of other cars were parked. He killed the engine and got out. He still had no clue what was going on. An attractive redhead in slacks and a sweater stood leaning against the fence. She turned to look at him and gave him a little finger wave. Avis Gent. He recognized her from the country club, though she'd dropped from sight after her divorce. She held her hand out.
"Hello, Walker. Fancy meeting you here."
He smiled and took her hand, leaning forward to give her a perfunctory buss on the cheek. "Avis, it's been ages. What have you been up to?"
"I just got back from my second stint in rehab. What a drag."
"Ouch. Big ouch," she replied. "How are Carolyn and the kids?"
"Good, thanks," he said. "What's this about? Was there an accident?"
"The police got a tip about a body buried in the woods." His smile faded.
"You're not serious."
"I'm afraid so. Someone said it was a kid, but that's as much as I've heard. The cops are very tight-lipped."
She removed a cigarette from a packet in her purse.
"I don't suppose you have a match."
He patted his pockets.
"No, sorry."
She waved him off.
"Just as well. I smoke too much as it is. Can you imagine? Horton Ravine, and cops are digging up a corpse."
"Unbelievable. No talk at all about what happened?"
"Nope. They brought in a cadaver-sniffing dog, and once they pinpointed the spot, they went to work. They started digging a couple of hours ago, and none of them looked happy," Avis said.
So what brings you out? Do you live around here?
A mile down in that direction. I was driving by when I saw the cars, and I was curious. What about you?
Alida Lane. They blocked off the street, so now I'm stuck. Shit. And it's cocktail hour.
Did this just happen today?
Avis shook her head. This was something old. They sent out an intrepid girl reporter, so I suppose we'll read about it in tomorrow's paper.
Walker's attention was drawn to a surge of activity. Two or three uniformed officers, led by a guy who must have been the homicide detective assigned to the scene. Walker nodded toward the group.
It looks like something's going on.
At long last, she replied.
He watched the detective make a brief remark to a woman in jeans. Walker saw him place an item in her hand, though he couldn't see what it was. A second woman zeroed in on the exchange, clearly peppering the detective with questions as he continued walking to his car.
Someone tapped Walker on the arm. Sir?
He turned to find a middle-aged man standing beside him, his expression anxious.
Sorry to interrupt, but I wouldn't advise parking there. They've been asking people to move on to keep the area clear. They said they'd be writing tickets if motorists didn't cooperate.
Thanks, but it looks like they're done. I'd hate to leave without knowing if they found anything.
The man glanced over at the commotion.
Oh, I guess you're right.
Walker could see word trickling through the crowd, those closest to the front turning to pass along what they'd heard.
Avis said, "Hang on."
She moved forward and made her way through the bystanders. She tapped a woman on the shoulder and quizzed her for news. The two chatted briefly. Avis nodded, gesturing her thanks, and then returned to Walker's side.
"Well, that's a relief," she said. "Turned out to be a false alarm. The only thing they managed to dig up was a dog."
"A dog?"
"Yeah, you know, dog, like a household pet. All this ruckus for nothing. But at least I can get home and belt back a few to catch up with myself."
Walker reached in his pants pocket for his car keys and realized he'd left them in the ignition.
"I guess I better take off as well. Nice seeing you."
Avis said, "You too. Behave yourself." He returned to his car and noticed she was watching him with an interest as he slid under the wheel. He smiled again and started his car, taking care as he backed out into the road. Driving home, he kept a close rein on his thoughts. He pulled the Mercedes into the garage and waited while the garage door rumbled down and closed with a thunk. He retrieved the liquor bag from the trunk and clutched it against him as he opened the door that led into the kitchen. When he set down the bag, the bottles of Maker's Mark and vodka made a satisfying clunk of glass on the granite countertop. Carolyn had left a note he didn't bother to read. She'd be reminding him of things that needed to be done or couldn't be overlooked in her absence. "Leave the alarm system off Friday morning so Ella can come in and clean. She should be done by noon. Just make sure she hasn't left any outside doors unlocked. Garbage goes out for pickup." It was always like that, his wife directing events from afar. He walked through the house, taking in the ordinary sights and smells. Carolyn had made an attempt to pick up after the kids in the minutes before they left, but it was still a house where unruly children lived. Fletcher's cowboy boots on the stairs waiting to be taken up, Linny's jacket thrown over the newel post, shoes, coloring books on the floor. Carolyn had left her knitting in a heap on the side table near the couch, the same ugly afghan she'd worked on for years. He circled through the living room where she'd drawn the drapes, leaving the room in a golden gloom. He passed through the dining room, with the round mahogany table and Chippendale chairs she had inherited from an aunt. He opened the china cabinet and removed an old-fashioned glass that was part of a set of Swarovski crystal he'd given Carolyn for their 10th anniversary. He went into the family room and crossed to the wet bar, where he opened the ice maker. He used the white plastic scoop to rattle ice into his glass. These were all sounds he loved, a prelude to the relief
The cessation of anxiety he knew was coming up. This was foreplay. He was setting the scene to maximize his pleasure. If he'd been into pornography, he couldn't have exercised greater care or self-control, teasing himself with his preparations, building his anticipation. Glass in hand, he returned to the kitchen, opened the Maker's Mark, and poured himself a drink. By then, a delayed reaction had set in. The mobile evidence van, police on the hill. His right hand started to shake so hard, the bottle banged against the rim of the glass. Carefully, he put both the bottle and the glass on the counter and leaned stiff-armed against the sink, hanging his head. Fear welled up like bile, and for a moment he thought he'd be sick. He took a deep breath, making a conscious effort to throw off his anxiety. He reached for the wall phone and punched in John's number. John picked up on his end.
Yes?
It's me. A brief, wary silence, and then John said,
Well, Walker, this is unexpected. What can I do for you?
You heard what's going on.
What would that be?
Walker could tell John was sorting through papers on his desk, reminding him that whatever Walker had to say, it was of less interest than the task in front of him. They're digging up the hill off Alita Lane. Cops, cadaver dog, evidence van, the works. The paper rustling stopped.
Really? When was this?
I saw them just now, on my way home from work. I pulled over and chatted with a gal I knew. She said they thought a child was buried on the hill. They dug up the dog.
I'm surprised it hasn't come up before. One way or another, something was bound to surface. There was always that risk.
Yes, but why now? Where's this shit coming from?
I have no idea. I'm sure we'll find out in due course. Are you all right?
So far, it's like waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Don't be paranoid. Nothing's going to happen.
So you've said, but here it is anyway.
Cool it, man. Would you do that? Be cool. This won't blow back on us, I guarantee.
Why, after all these years?
No clue. The cops don't consult with me.
But what could have happened?
Walker, it doesn't matter. It's a dead end, so drop it.
Where's Carolyn?
Up north, at her mother's. She took the kids.
Until when?
Monday.
Good. Gives you time to simmer down and get your head on straight.
Take a chill pill, Walker said, echoing John's unspoken admonition from their teen years.
Exactly. I'm sorry, but I had to call.
Good you did. Let me know if you hear anything else.
John hung up without waiting for a response. Walker replaced the headset in the mount on the wall. He lifted the glass and swallowed the whiskey in one smooth motion, and then said,
Oh.
Something loosened in his chest. The old familiar sensation he'd been longing for. He shook his head. He'd be fine. Everything was good. He left his glass on the counter and went out to the mailbox. He brought in the mail and tossed it on the hall table. He made sure the front door was locked, and then he returned to the kitchen and refilled his glass. 2 fingers of Maker's Mark, the rest water. Easy does it, he thought. He shucked his jacket and placed it on the back of a kitchen chair. He opened the French doors and went out onto the patio. He settled in an upholstered chair and set his drink next to him, as he'd imagined it. He removed his tie and unbuttoned his shirt collar, feeling he could breathe for the first time all day. He loved his life. He was a lucky guy, and he knew that. Restless, he got up and carried his drink with him as he crossed the grass. He strolled the perimeter of the yard, looking out over the wood rail fence. In the distance, he could see the fairway for the 5th hole at the country club he and Carolyn had joined shortly after moving to town. The membership fees were steep, $80,000 up front and $500 a month in dues thereafter. They also got assessed for any capital improvements, not that he objected. He'd taken a secret pride in their acceptance.
given the fact that his own parents had been turned down when they applied years before. Walker was coming up in the world. He turned to look back at the house, which was all charm, Cape Cod style, with white clapboard siding and a steeply pitched roof. The large central chimney was linked to fireplaces in two rooms, upstairs and down. Carolyn had insisted on an extensive remodel before the kids came along. There was more time for construction than either of them anticipated. Carolyn had no problem getting pregnant, but she miscarried four times and lost another baby at 16 weeks. Faced with the prohibitive expense of additional infertility treatments after five failed intrauterine inseminations, they'd elected to adopt. Carolyn took charge of the process and powered everything through: background check, fingerprinting, a lengthy application with attendant paperwork, letters of recommendation, followed by home visits that included separate and joint interviews. It took 3 months to be approved, and they expected to wait for a year before a baby came through. Fletcher, the wonder boy, dropped in their laps 6 weeks later when his intended adoptive mother learned she was pregnant with twins. When Fletcher was two, Carolyn went back into high gear. The process was simpler that time, since many of the same approvals were in place. Linny came to them by way of a local adoption attorney who'd been chatting with Carolyn at a Christmas party. The bio mom, unmarried and 8.5 months pregnant, had come into his office the week before. The baby's father refused to marry her. She'd lost her job, and her parents had kicked her out of the house. Would the McNallys be interested? There was no discussion at all. The birth mom moved into the McNallys' guest room for the final weeks before the birth. Carolyn and Walker were both present in the delivery room when Linny was born. When his second drink was gone, he went back to the kitchen and fixed himself a short one. His tension had dimmed, and the knot of anxiety in his gut was all but gone. He noticed that 8 months of good behavior had boosted the effects of the booze. He loved the sensation. He couldn't help himself. Alcohol gave him access to his feelings. He experienced an extraordinary appreciation of his wife, his children, and the life he lived. Ordinarily, he held his emotions in check. He lived in a state of detachment, a stance he'd developed years before as a matter of self-preservation. He was present in his head, but his sentimental side was seldom given free rein. It was in quiet moments like these that he let down his guard. Walker still teared up on occasion, watching his two little ones who resembled Carolyn so closely enough to be mistaken for her real kids, instead of the miraculous blessings they were. Where his love for his wife was constant, his devotion to his children overrode everything. Through them, he'd been made vulnerable. His heart had opened to them in wholly unexpected ways. He'd been surprised by the depth and tenderness of his feelings, because his soft side was in evidence nowhere else. The loss of either child would be a blow he could never recover from. His only prayer, on the rare occasions when he prayed, was that Fletcher and Linny would be protected from evil and violence, spared illness and injury, disease and death. No one knew better than he how fragile life was. At 7 o'clock, he called in an order for a large pizza with onions, jalapenos, and anchovies, a combination that would have made Carolyn shudder. The guy on the phone said it would be 30 minutes, which was fine with him. He changed into sweats and slippers and then went into the den, where he unfolded a TV tray and set it with a paper napkin, a dinner plate, and silverware. When the pizza arrived, he'd make himself a proper drink that he'd nurse while he ate. He pictured an early evening, maybe reading in bed before he turned out the light. All he had to do was hang tight and act like everything was fine. Chapter 10. Friday, April 8th, 1988. I skipped my run the next morning and went into the office early. I knew a 3-mile jog would wipe out the lingering sense of melancholy I felt. But sometimes when you're down in the dark, you lose the will to come up. The mood would pass as the day wore on. In some ways, I was sorry I'd seen the black-and-white photograph of Mary Claire. In that brief glimpse, I'd seen the mischief in her face and the light in her eyes. Before that moment, she'd been little more than a concept. Mary Claire Fitzhugh, who'd vanished from the face of the earth. Now her life had touched mine, and her fate had left a mark as delicate and distinct as a fingerprint. I made a note in Michael Sutton's file and stuck it in the drawer, then went back to the rough draft of the report I'd begun writing 2 days before. I revised and polished and typed it into final form. I began work on the second report, knowing I'd have to take 2 or 3 runs at it. This part of the business always felt like high school to me, as if I had a term paper due and my final grade depended on it. I suffered so much performance anxiety at Santa Teresa High, it just about shut me down. Once Ben Bird and Morley Shine had trained me and I was out on my own, I understood that the whole point of a client report was clarity, laying out the sequence of events in an orderly fashion with sufficient detail that a stranger reading the file years later could follow the course of an investigation. That I could do. I'd even learned to enjoy the process, though it didn't come easily. I paid my bills and made the bank run, depositing a collection of miscellaneous checks that I had accumulated during the week, plus the $500 Sutton had paid me, which I'd removed from my office safe. While I was out, I picked up a sandwich and chips at the deli near the bank. The sandwich was a wicked one that I allowed myself once a year. A thick layer of liverwurst with mayonnaise and thinly sliced dill pickle on freshly baked sourdough. While I would never dream of slapping a big glistening liver between 2 slices of bread, liverwurst was close to heaven. The poor man's pate. I know organ meats play hell with my cholesterol levels, but I doubted the occasional indulgence would prove fatal. I was in the habit of eating so fast, maybe nothing would adhere. Halfway through the sandwich, I heard the outer office door open and close. I slid the sandwich, waxed paper and all, into my pencil drawer and wiped my mouth in haste. When I looked up, Diana Alvarez was standing at my door. She wore a snug black turtleneck and a short, preppy-looking pleated skirt over black tights. Her low-heeled patent leather shoes had little brass buckles across the tops that were ever so pert. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, a style that magnified her dark brown eyes behind rimless glasses. She said, "Mind if I sit down? Be my guest." As she settled in the chair, she straightened her skirt under her to avoid wrinkling the fabric. Over one shoulder, she had a small bag on a thin leather strap. I'm constitutionally incapable of toting anything that small. Hers probably contained her driver's license, a tube of lipstick, her mad money, 1 credit card, and her little spiral-bound notebook with a pen stuck to the wire loops. I was hoping she had a tissue tucked in there somewhere for nasal emergencies. "What's on your mind?" I anticipated a few follow-up questions about the dig the day before. Maybe she'd apologize for being pushy and deceptive. Traits I found attractive in myself, but unappealing in her. "We need to talk about Michael Sutton," she said. I went through an automatic sorting process, wondering, 1, how and what she knew about Michael Sutton. 2, whether she was fishing to confirm my professional relationship with him. And 3, whether I was still bound by ethical constraints now that our one-day business dealings had come to an end. What, if anything, was I at liberty to disclose? Where did that name come from? Cheney Phillips told me he talked to Michael at the station and then referred him to you. I spotted Michael at the dig yesterday, and since you were at the scene as well, I'm assuming he hired you. Is that correct? Even without her spiral notebook at hand, she was confirming the facts. Why not ask him? I don't want to talk to him. Too bad. I don't intend to conduct a conversation behind his back, so there you have it. We don't have to behave like antagonists. I'm here to save you a few headaches. I opened my mouth to interrupt, and she held up 1 hand. Just listen to me, she said. I didn't realize what was going on until I saw his MG parked by the side of the road. I'd been sent to cover the story, so I waited like everyone else to see what they'd find. I assumed the police were operating on an anonymous tip, and then it dawned on me Michael was involved.
That still doesn't tell me why you're here.
She cocked her head, and the light glinting off her glasses was like a quick camera flash. I'm his sister, Dee.
Ah, Dee, the difficult one.
I looked at her closely, seeing for the first time Sutton's solemn brown eyes staring back at me.